Renowned master trombonist J.J. Johnson with his equally renowned composition, Minor Blues. Toots Thielemans on guitar in this selection, Jimmy Heath on tenor and baritone sax, Harold Mayburn, McCoy Tyner, both on piano, Arthur Harper and Richard Davis on bass, and Frank Gant and Elvin Jones, both on drums. This is from his 1994 album, Proof Positive. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And you know, it looks like people were listening to us yesterday. Oh, my goodness. Never a dull moment. I want to start off by talking about this march, this national protest, I should say, not a march, but a protest, conducted by young people, most of them in high school, and doing so to draw attention to the fact that the gun violence must end. This, of course, as you know, was as a result of the massacre that occurred last month in Parkland, Florida, where 17 students were mowed down with an assault rifle by a former student with some major mental problems. But they decided that something had to be done. The response was not swift by the government from the student's point of view. There was no real movement toward a genuine, thorough solution. So they decided to dramatize their concern by staging a nationwide walkout of classes and dramatizing the need for immediate attention, legislative attention, to solving this problem of people having easy access to assault rifles and other things too. The general ease at which people can get guns across the board. And we have all kinds of modifications that are legal that many people who own guns are making. The case in point was the massacre in Las Vegas, where the shooter attached something called a bump stock to his assault rifle. And that enabled him to fire off bullets at a rapid rate. So all these things are in the mix. Of course, we see that the NRA is not having any of it and has begun a major pushback, intimidating even the president of the United States. And it's understandable since they pumped $30 million into his campaign. He is not likely to go up against the wishes of the NRA. But still, these young people persisted. They made their point, and they have further plans to become more involved in advocating for gun control. the thing I wanted to talk about is that, you know, all right, so the students are protesting, and it was a very good gesture, a very good gesture in the sense that they acknowledged that the deaths of these 17 young people in Parkland, in a way, was so deeply touched them. They literally saw themselves in these students' place. And so it was an emotional connection that they were expressing. Also, of course, the main business of dramatizing the fact that although we see these incidents occurring time and again, there is no definitive legislation that could help alleviate some of this stuff. It can't avoid it completely. But the fact that there is no sense of urgency about addressing this problem. So even as the students took this measure, a very simple measure, a very touching one, and one that was remarkable in the sense that they organized themselves to do this. You know that so many schools across the country took punitive action against the students. Some even locked them out when they left the building to do their walkout and their memorial to the 17 who died. Many couldn't get back in some cases. In other cases, they were threatened with detention and all kinds of silly punitive action being taken here to basically discourage them from doing what I think was a very touching and a very remarkable thing, which I thought the schools would see these actions as, in fact, the fulfillment of what we want in young people. We want them to embrace responsibility. We want them to take their share of the burden to transform society. We want them involved in this way. And it is so sad that several schools, not too many, but several, enough to cause one to take note. Instead of encouraging the students and supporting them, all they were doing is taking 17 minutes, that's all, 17 minutes out of class time to conduct this this ceremony and this remembrance. And it is a shame, really, that many schools across the country saw it fit to take action against these students for, quote, breaking the rules, I guess. It's just so silly, unnecessary. But it mirrors the tone, you see, of the White House and this administration. They're going to punish you. You know, you're going to be totally controlled. And 17 minutes of solidarity with students all across the country will cost you. Will cost you. It says something about the atmosphere in which many students are functioning or are forced to function every day. Rather than school being a place that embraces a child's potential, it instead suffocates. That's too bad. That's too sad. And you wonder how it is On the same day that they did that, the country of Finland was voted by a UN, some UN body, voted the happiest nation in the world. Isn't that a great mark of distinction? To be voted the happiest country in the world. If only we could figure out how to translate what they're doing to the United States, it would be a great thing that people would be living joyful, happy lives and not have an adversarial relationship with the government, in which the government is doing everything possible to snuff out initiative, to punish you for being ambitious. It's just so sad. Well, they also were listening to our program yesterday, it seems, because I talked about President Trump's fitness for office, as we've talked about before. And we have a congressman from California who's saying that, I mean, really now they must push for the impeachment of President Trump, because Trump, in a recent speech, or he made a presentation to a group and happened to mention the fact, and he thought it was funny, he thought it was a nice little ditty to tell. He mentioned that in a recent meeting he had with the Canadian Prime Minister, Trudeau, that he lied and said, you know, there was a trade deficit with Canada. And Trudeau was alarmed by it and said, absolutely not. He doesn't know that there's any trade deficit with Canada, with the U.S. and Canada. And Trump insisted, yes. So he was recounting this this little tete-a-tete he had with Trudeau. And he thought it was funny. He thought it was very, very funny. But apparently, Representative Ted Lieu of California doesn't think it's funny at all. He says that intentional lying and misrepresenting at that level, you know, here's a president talking to the prime minister, making false statements, knowingly making false statements about something that was so concerning. In fact, it was at that meeting, after that meeting, immediately Trudeau dispatched his people to double-check this so-called deficit that Canada has with the United States, this trade deficit that Canada has with the United States. And, in fact, there is none. So, according to Congressman Lieu of California, this should constitute a real effort now to impeach Trump. This is not the conduct expected of a president of the United States. You don't go around lying and misrepresenting facts. You don't go around putting people on the spot thinking, you know, it's a salesman's joke. Ha, ha, ha. It's not funny. And it's deliberate. Now, if this doesn't prove, or it may not prove it, but it certainly does give great credence to what I've been talking about. This president is not in his right mind. And we have no idea, literally, when he goes abroad or even domestically here in the United States when he travels, we have no idea what he's likely to say. And whenever he says something, we have no idea whether he's telling the truth. It's a really lousy way and a really lousy state of affairs when the head of state is a pathological liar. He lies to the people. He lies to other heads of state. He just lies. And again, people are accepting this as, well, you know, that's Donald Trump. You know, he's a special kind of guy. He's a very, really, very brilliant kind of guy. And so we should overlook some of these things, because in the end, we should pay attention more to what he produces and, you know, kind of give him the leeway and the latitude he needs to be himself. Because when Donald Trump is himself, he is at the best for the nation, you know, that kind of silly rationale. But this is not funny. This is very serious. And, you know, what are the penalties for a president who lies like that to another head of state? So we have the continuing chaos of the White House, and we have the president taking action now, punitive action against Russians, besides the regular punitive actions. These are now additional punitive actions he's taking because of the suspicion. I don't know that they've proven that the 19 diplomats associated with Russia are being sanctioned for their alleged role in the 2016 elections. And we have now the official beginning of a kind of tension that nobody needs. Nobody needs it. Now, does that mean that the Russians Russia was involved? We have no conclusive proof. I mean, Mueller is supposed to be probing these things. I don't think that he has come up yet with the definitive proof. When it was first alleged, when Hillary Clinton also was a candidate, and she said Russia is interfering with the elections, and they began to investigate the nation's intelligence services, all said no, no such thing, and no hacking was going on. But, you know, it's hanging there like a cloud that just wouldn't go away and or be made to go away. Did they do it or did they not? Could we get a definitive answer? But we have all of these investigations and probes that are concurrent and that are looking at everything, but we haven't seen any definitive results yet from all of these probes that are running. So my thing is, hey, you know, get something done. Close something definitively. Tell us what your findings were. Don't leave this, you know, it's like a permanent institution now, this, the Institute of Ongoing Probes that are not ending and that haven't in some ways, at least to our public understanding, a critical point. Tell us what's going on. Indict people if they need to be indicted, and let's get on with the prosecutions. But it just is going on and on and on. And I can't believe that, I can only believe that these probes started off kind of narrow, and they suddenly started to expand and expand and expand, so that the initial reason for the probe no longer is tenable, because now something else has come up. We haven't gotten a report, and we haven't gotten any indication from Mueller just where things stand with these investigations and prosecutions. It's time for some prosecutions, don't you think? If, in fact, these probes are yielding information this serious that would inculpate so many people for doing so much wrongdoing, then let's get something moving. You know, Hillary Clinton is touring India and having a fine time, falling downstairs and everything, as if, you know, there's nothing to worry about. And yet we're told there's so much to worry about. So at some point, I think there has to be a push for Mueller to make clear just what the status is of these various probes that he's handling, and which of these probes has come to the point where somebody is indictable and somebody is prosecutable or not. You know, it's we can't have this. All right. Which brings me to this subject today. I mean, whether you like Donald Trump or not, and I know the feeling out there, but almost nobody is neutral about Donald Trump as president. But whether pro or con on the president, I think you can agree that he has dramatically changed what we call the political landscape. For good or for bad, this is what we're going to be talking about today. And I'm hoping you can help us understand, in the last year, in what ways has Trump changed the body politic of the United States? For good, you'll tell us. For bad, you'll tell us. And do we see a way of returning to something that looks even remotely familiar? You know, or has he changed things so dramatically that we no longer can accept the old political landscape as the current political landscape anymore, because he has changed things so radically? Again, up to you to decide yay or nay, but I would like to know, from your observation, from your analysis, in what ways would you say that the political landscape has changed dramatically, and perhaps forever? We don't know. And what is the impact of that, in your view, for what is the import of that for politics in the United States? All right, so that's the issue today. We'll take this break and come back to your calls. And so it will be 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I got a note from the engineer that we might be running slow, but we will take calls as they come in anyway. All right, so after this break, 888-874-4888, we get on with the assignment for today. We'll be right back. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Trace Lead, and I've just been apprised of a small hiccup that our site is working slowly so that we may not be getting your phone calls as rapidly as they should come in, or we may not get them at all today. But let's start with Tony from Orlando.
Hi, Trees. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling in. What are your thoughts about Trump and whether he has changed permanently, whether for good or for bad, you'll tell us, in your view? How has he changed the body politic in the United States?
Well, I think he's changed it in a way where he's shed to light. He's woken up that white supremacist spirit in this country. He is pretty much their voice. And Trump in itself, he's not a master plan guy. He's a phony showman. And that is the reason why the last three big political issues he's dealt with and pretty much done nothing on, whether you are for those issues or not. The first was repeal and replace Obamacare. He basically told Congress, whatever you send me, I'm going to sign for it. That was signal number one to tell everybody that this guy had no clue as to what even Obamacare was about to begin with. Secondly, when it came to immigration, he made the phony baloney fake show to distract. He's good at distracting, by the way. He made the phony baloney fake show, having the meeting, saying, yeah, send me anything and I'll sign it. Then the next day, he flip-flops and goes on totally against the plan. And then thirdly, when the people from that were protesting, trying to get some kind of common sense gun legislation going, he said, yeah, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And he chastised the other politicians of how afraid they were of the NRA. And you don't have to be afraid of the NRA. And then the next day, the NRA has lunch with him, and he changed his tune right away. And so he really doesn't know. And the same thing what you were talking about with the supposed – we don't have if anything, Canada buys more goods from us. We don't have a trade deficit with Canada. So he's completely uninformed as far as the details of the nitty-gritty of what's really going on. He's just good
but I have to ask you
riding the wave of public sentiment. That's what
I have
he's
to
good
ask
at.
You this. What, yeah. if what made it possible? Because, I mean, these problems and these constituencies that you said that he awoke, and you're right about that. How is it that they weren't awakened by the forces that existed before Trump?
Because the same reason why the Republican Party, which he belongs to supposedly today, didn't like him. He was not polished enough to hide their true intentions. See, I already called in here and I expressed my opinions of what I think this country is a white supremacist country based upon the history and the Second Amendment that was just to prevent uprising from within. And I'm not just making those things up, because just a couple of weeks ago, the top number one conservative talk show host said it himself. He said that the left wants to take our guns away so that they can take the land away, just like what's going on in South Africa today. So it's not something that was to prevent an uprising a long time ago, but also is within current times. That's the way they feel. So those intentions are there still today. Even though the others, I love how you called us the others yesterday. Even though the others are enjoying the rights of the Constitution, which, in my opinion, well, I know it's not opinion, I know it's fact, was not intentionally written for the others at the time it was written. It was written for the invaders, the conquerors. It was specifically written for them, because we all know that, you know, when they say all men are created equal, what they didn't view the others as being equal men as them. Otherwise, they would not have treated us as poorly as they did, because they treated their enemies back then better than they treated us. So I believe that's why, like, when Obama became president, when Obama was running, and Joe Biden, he said, oh, he is so articulate. He is so smart. He speaks so well. You know what? That's code word for he can keep the lid on what's really going on. It's what it is.
So let me ask
That's why they didn't like Trump.
I'm sorry? How do you grade? I mean, not that you agree or anything, but how do you grade Trump's performance with respect to what you suspect it was his end game? Is he on his end game? Has he gone significantly down the road with his end game? What do you think?
His end game is pretty much to look as good as he possibly can. Now, these political parties, I believe, they're so horrible. I mean, like, I think it's starting to come to a point where there's a wall. He's coming up to a wall. And you talked about this whole thing with Russia where we don't need that right now. Well, I believe the reason we're here is because Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party came up with this whole Russia thing as an excuse because they lost the election to a jokester, a showman like Trump. They couldn't believe it. They're like, who is this guy? He's not a polished, you know, he's not articulate like Obama, you know. He was this guy that's probably going to spill the beans on what's going on, which he did when he said that Obama tapped the tower. Remember when he said that? He wasn't supposed to say that. You know, that was something you're not supposed to say. That's like inside politics. You're not supposed to talk about that, you know, out in the public. So they were like, who's this idiot? You know, that's why people call him an idiot. He's unfit, because that's what they see him as. You know, I hear a lot of talk about impeachment. I don't think that's the way to go with this guy. What we have to do, well, whoever wants to defeat him, coming the next election, they have to point out the inconsistencies in his policy, because he has no policy. And they need to point that out. That's the way you're going to, because playing by his rules, it's not going to get anyone anywhere. And this whole Russia thing to try to get, I believe it was a narrative to try to get him impeached. All it's doing is straining relations with Russia. And I'm not saying they're the good guys or anything like that, but we shouldn't give Russia so much power as to say that they have so much influence over us. Because if we want, we can have way more influence on them if we really wanted to, which is probably what that is the case. We have more power than they do. But giving them so much power is not good for us standing in the world, you know, because it's creating strain with us and the allies, and it's giving more power to Russia when they don't really deserve that power at this given time.
I'm looking more for, I appreciate your points, and you're making very good points. I'm looking from you for a bit more guidance on how you used to see politics, or how did politics resonate with you prior to this campaign, and now a full year into the Trump presidency. Do you sense something dramatically different has occurred? And do you have a finger, or you have an idea of what it is?
Yes. Before Trump, see, I'm part of the others, and the Democrat Party has taken the mantle of representing the others in this country. And I've always seen that what they've done is make us be dependent on them for the things we do in life. And I've seen that that has crippled us as a people and as a society. The black family in this country has been destroyed enormously because, you know, we have been more dependent on this government to solve all our problems. And you know, right now, as we stand right now, as a people in this country, you know, we are in shambles. The family is destroyed. There's no, I mean, we're killing each other on the streets. It's just destroyed. So I saw all of that, and I said, you know what? I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to be part of that political system that is telling me that they're helping me, but at the same time, they're destroying my who I am, you know, by making me dependent on them, by telling me that the other party is racist, this, that, and the other. So then I said, well, let me break away from that, because I don't want them to make, I don't want to be a slave on the plantation. I've heard you say that before, and that's how I felt at that time. So we're in the two-party system, so I went to the Republican side. And I realized, okay, you know what? With Trump, he exposed that, yes, they are racist. Those things that the Democrats said about the Republicans being racist, those are true, because the immigration policies that they want to put in place, not only the Second Amendment right protects their, or is going to ensure that no one's going to take their land the way what's happening in South Africa, where the people that created injustices are losing their land rightfully because they took that land unjustly. So the people that are oppressed are obviously going to uprise and take what's theirs back. That's what they're trying to prevent here with the Second Amendment. But not only that, they want to make sure that they remain the majority by closing the doors on the borders. So that just woke me up even more when I saw how racist this Trump's agenda and policies and the people that support that and remain and continue to support that. Because one thing is to say, okay, I vote for this guy or whatever, and then if he's not doing things right, you need to call him out on what he's doing. And this party's not doing that. And just yesterday, a Democrat won an election in Pennsylvania running as a Democrat with Republican values. So that tells me that the two parties are pretty much the same garbage. And that's why I say if the only party that's going to run against this, you know, the ruling party that's existing now is obviously the Democrat Party. If they want to win, they're just going to have to imitate whatever garbage the other party's doing and fill in the gaps wherever they can't fill it in.
Well, you gave us quite an overview, and it's clear you have a handle on this. And I want to encourage this discussion to go further because, you know, it's like anything else. The more you understand about it, the more empowered you are. And we are acting, most of us, I think, you know, reflexively. But we really need to pause a little bit and say, what is happening here? And thank you for giving us the tour, Tony. Thanks so much for calling in today. From Dover, Emilio, you're on the air.
Yes, hello?
Hello, Emilio. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I just, you know, as far as, you know, I'm not a Trump supporter, but I think his presidency in a way it was good for America because I expected, it woke people up pretty much. The veil is off. You know, the diplomatic way of keeping people suppressed in their place and, you know, brutalized and so on. Now people can see it up close and personal. So that's my first point. My second point is I think that now it shows that the president is not really in control, and I mean any president, but so much, I mean more so for President Trump, because if you remember during his campaign, he spoke about, you know, normalizing relations with Russia, kind of normalizing a lot of that, the foreign policy interference that, not normalizing, I'm sorry, preventing or doing away with a lot of that intervention overseas. He talked about, you know, keeping Social Security and Medicare. And now you see, little by little, his cabinet is being taken over by people that are just the opposite of what he was campaigning on in terms of the policies that they want to push forward. Okay, my third point is, what's bad about it, you know, is that there's this vacuum created because both the Democrats and Republicans are in disarray. Nobody really supports them, but nobody's coming up. No organized party is coming up to fill the vacuum so that all of us that don't belong to those two parties can organize, donate, and get out there and do something about it. And my fourth point is I think he's just a useful idiot for the Republicans right now, and that's why they're allowing him to be the president. Because as long as they can control him and as long as they can get him to do what they want, why get rid of him? So those are my four points.
Well, I like point number three that you made. I would start at the top with that.
Okay.
You made the point about a vacuum. Trump made the most of a vacuum of leadership, and it was wide open, and you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And by contrast, people were willing to be entertained because at least he was trying to connect with the people in a way that they hadn't gotten a connection from the Republicans or the Democrats, and even, and to some degree, even from the third-party efforts that were made. But there was, and you're right on point for that, there was this major vacuum, a political vacuum, and it was, you know, the Republicans on one end, the Democrats on the other, and they were indistinguishable from each other, really. So
right.
He comes into this vacuum and he injects all kinds of things that get people excited. He's talking code words, dog whistle, racist. He's talking about conservative values. He's talking about things that his people, as he identified them, in that belt of America, nobody paid attention to them, really. So the vacuum of leadership was his best ally. And I think you're smart to point that out. But let me ask you.
Yeah.
Based on, you know, we can go just from the beginning of the election cycle until now, a year plus into his presidency. How do you compare Trump the candidate to Trump the president, and what has he changed?
Well, I think that's what I was trying to say. Maybe I didn't say it enough or clearly enough, but, you know, it to me, I see that maybe Trump actually believes some of this stuff. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he wanted to really do, you know, normalize relations with Russia, maybe don't interfere as much in overseas, in the Middle East, and so on and so forth. But what I see is that it looks like he's not really the one making the decisions. He's just the one that is announcing the decisions that are made by the people that really are controlling the government. And so Trump, the candidate, to me, I think you're absolutely right. He did fill a vacuum, but I think some of his stuff was sincere, I think. And he isn't allowed to do the things, especially on the foreign policy side, domestically, he was they're probably giving him a lot of what he wants. But in terms of foreign policy, I think that he's being constrained. His recent appointment of the torturer to the CIA, Pompeo as Secretary of State. You know, you have people that are war hawks are being put in places or in cabinet positions that I think are trying to get us into a war in Russia, the Middle East, you name it. And I don't think that Trump really wanted that. And since he's been president, if you notice, a lot of the people that were very close to him are no longer there. So he's kind of lost his defense, if you will. And now I think he's even more susceptible to being controlled because he doesn't have people that he can trust. And he says he can trust Pompeo. I don't believe that. I just believe that these people were picked and he's just following orders. So to me, Trump the candidate and Trump as president are two different people.
Whose orders is Trump following, you think?
Well, you know, I kind of follow a lot of the foreign policy. I just think it's the people that benefit from us being in war. The constant, and you know, it's funny, but if you criticize Israel, you know, they call you anti-Semitic. I think that's, you know, political correctness going crazy. I think that the Israel lobby has too much influence in this country. I think that, of course, the arms industry, they want to sell weapons. You know, the military, I was in the military. The military doesn't like when their budget is cut. I just think that there's this, you know, I don't say it's a cabal. I just think it's all of these interests that want to maintain the situation as it is because they make money from it. And Trump is not strong enough or smart enough to, you know, Obama, I'll give him that. He was a smart guy. I you know, I voted for him. I'm not happy of what about what he accomplished and all the things that he flip-flopped on, but at least I'll give him that. It seems like he had a brain and he was able to, you know, play the end game or maybe, you know, divert something or be able to put something to prevent some of these people from getting what they want. But I don't think Trump is capable of that.
Do you think at the same time that you're pretty clear about what's going on with Trump and him coming into a vacuum, do you think that the vacuum still exists when it comes to the progressive community or the third party movements?
Oh yeah. I voted green. I kind of was hoping that more people voted green so it wouldn't be as difficult, you know, to get on the ballot in 2020, but apparently that didn't happen. So, you know, Bernie maybe was a possibility running as an independent because he had a very, very strong support. He had very loyal people that are willing to go out there and do what they need to do to make him president. So, I think that's what's needed. Not necessarily Bernie, but something like that, because we got a lot of people, let's face it, non-affiliated and independents are the largest group of people, voters in this country. And so somebody has to appeal to them. And I don't feel that there's an organized effort to do that. And so what we're left with is the same Democrat and Republican duopoly. Oh. That seems to continue the same thing over and over again. So the prospects of anything really changing in 2020 is zero for me. I don't see it.
Oh, wow. Well, Michael, you took us on a tour, a very good tour, too. Thank you so much for participating today and sharing your thoughts. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice.
Hi.
So it's a pleasure. It was great seeing you at the church.
Yes, it was great meeting you, seeing your voice.
And, you know, I got a lot out of your talk, and you had discussed it on the radio, but you focused it and expanded it and moved it in new directions, which I thought was great. You know, I think the political landscape it may be changing, or it just may be like a glacier that's moving a little faster, that it was always always moving in that direction. And I think that what's happening is that there's a major movement seems to be to denigrate, or, you know, we talked about identity politics, and there's been a, when it's ever I hear that word identity politics, it's mostly in the pejorative. It's like welfare, you know, it's a beautiful word, welfare. What could be higher value than the welfare of the people? But they made it into a dirty word. They gave it a meaning, and we were conditioned to think of it in a pejorative sense. And what is identity politics? I mean, I think maybe even we discussed it, and it was we discussed it in the pejorative. But actually, it's the minorities, it's the oppressed. It's groups of people that are oppressed that identify with their own group, and they form constituencies, and they can develop influence for their own issues. But, you know, again, just like welfare with Bill Clinton and everybody denigrating that value of human welfare, they're denigrating minorities and oppressed people, and they're making it impossible. And really, the Democrats have made a mockery of identity politics, just pandering to these various groups in order to exploit them, to get their vote. So I think we have to think a little more about this identity politics. And I think what they're afraid of is that the identity politics that the groups will merge together and form bigger groups of people that have common interests. And what's the general trend is to weaken government, weaken representation, and weaken people's rights to protest, like we were talking about with the kids with the school. And all the power that's coming away from the people, which we're supposed to have all the power, it's being usurped, and it's been given to the corporations, the private interests. And anybody now, more and more so, if you go to some of these industrial parks or where these big corporation headquarters are, they're like their own cities, their own government. They have their corporate governance. They make their own universe, really. And they're in charge. And Trump is giving them more and more power, taking away all the regulations. And so in order to survive, we talk about survival, you have to be affiliated with one of these big corporations, because
we have to leave it there for today because we're out of time. But we certainly can pick it up tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday. But you always have something extraordinarily insightful to share. And I hope that you return tomorrow to continue the discussion. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. And tomorrow, it's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories. Hope to meet you there. Bye-bye.